The vast majority of dogs would initially present with skin lesions. There's no pathognomonic appearance for them. So, you know, there's not a picture of one lesion that I can show you and say, this is a CRGV skin lesion. But in 80% of patients, they're on the limbs, often below the elbow, below the knee, sometimes interdigitally. When I read the histories that vets have written, they're understandably confused with other things like interdigital foreign bodies or just areas of dermatitis. Vets in practice will be seeing huge numbers of skin cases, and the chances of it actually being on CRGV are incredibly low. The real difficulty, however, is that because the lesions can look so innocuous, you can never really say it's not CRGV.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Vet Times podcast. My name's James Westgate, and today we're here to talk about cutaneous and renal glomerular vasculopathy, better known as Alabama rot. And we've got the UK's leading expert with us today to help us do that. That's David Walker from Anderson Moores in Hampshire. How's it going, David?
Yeah, very well. Thank you, James. Thank you for inviting me on to talk about this today.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. So far this year, I understand we've got 23 confirmed cases. Is that correct now?
Yeah, that's correct. So that's since the start of this year. That comes off the back of 47 cases in 2020. And we've got 274 confirmed cases now since we first recognized this disease in the UK in the back end of 2012. You know, so in the grand scheme of things, still reasonably low case numbers. But unfortunately, to confirm a case, that means a dog has lost their life. So yeah, still far more cases than we would want to be seeing.
Yeah, and we'll just go over a little bit of history. You mentioned then, I think 2012, when this thing first got confirmed in the UK. I think there was probably similar reports from racing dogs or greyhounds in the States or something like that originally, which made you think that there was a connection. So just tell us a little bit of the history, how we came to this stage now. And obviously, originally, it was considered to be maybe something that was confined to a certain geographical spot. We now know it's a national thing. So just a little bit of a history for people who perhaps don't know.
Yes, absolutely. So CRGV is a disease that was first reported in the United States in the 1980s and 1990s. And at that stage, it was a disease that solely affected greyhounds. So they were the only breed that were reported with the disease. And there was a fair bit of work done in the 80s and 90s in the US looking for the possible underlying cause, but nothing was found. There was some theory that it might be linked into feeding of raw food, but that was never founded. There was a theory that it might be related to E. coli, but again, you know, that was never proven. And then it all went a little bit quiet. You know, I think many people going through vet school would have heard about this disease maybe in their dermatology lectures, you know, in a passing sentence, but, you know, we didn't really think anything of it. And then we saw a couple of dogs here back end of 2012 presented with sudden onset kidney failure and skin lesions. First dog, I must say, you know, we didn't really think a huge amount about it. But a second case, we thought, you know, this is a bit weird to be seeing the combination of skin lesions and kidney failure together, because those two things don't normally go hand in hand. And we got a post-mortem. And the histopathological changes, so the tissue changes in the kidney and the skin, were very much looking like what was reported in the US in the 80s and 90s in greyhounds. So we thought, you know, this is CRGV, often known as Alabama rot, and really it moved forward from there. And what's been fascinating in the UK is that it's been affecting all sorts of different breeds of dogs. You know, this is no longer the disease of the greyhound. And, you know, I suppose that then begs the question, you know, are we dealing with exactly the same pathology, exactly the same disease as we were in the 80s and 90s? I mean, certainly the analysis of the tissues is the same, but obviously that doesn't necessarily mean that the cause is the same. So yeah, really quite fascinating how things have developed. And we've also done a little bit of work just asking medicine specialists, dermatology specialists in the UK, saying, you know, were you seeing this before 2012? And the answer seemingly is no. You know, so this seems like it's a new disease process to the UK since 2012.
How did it get here? How did it suddenly manifest itself? Was it always here? It just wasn't being recognized. It wasn't being reported, because I understand that's an issue with this. Obviously, you rely on dogs with these symptoms being reported. And obviously then you do the post-mortem checks to establish that that was the cause. But it's fascinating, I guess, to me, non-vet and to vets across the country, that the veterinary detective work that's going on at the moment to find out the cause of this thing, the causal agents, suspicions it's seasonal, et cetera, et cetera. But why do you think it suddenly emerged then? Was it just better surveillance, or is it something genuinely new, and how did it get it?
Yeah, it's a great question, James. And, you know, it's one we've been asking ourselves, you know, was this here pre-2012 and it just wasn't being recognized? Nobody was reporting it, putting two and two together, or actually, yeah, is it completely new since 2012? Going back to what I was saying before, I mean, we did ask medicine specialists, we did ask dermatology specialists, you know, do you think you were seeing this disease before 2012? And the clear answer was, no, we don't think we were, which suggests that probably, this is a new disease process that we've only been seeing in the UK since 2012. That increases our index of suspicion that there may well be an environmental trigger. You know, I've talked before about theories as to what might be causing this disease, and this is pure speculation, but what might be happening is that the dogs that develop this disease might have an underlying predisposition. So they might be pre-programmed to develop the disease, but then they come into contact with some sort of environmental trigger, you know, so that might be a microorganism, for example, a virus or a bacteria, you know, and that could potentially fit in quite nicely, because if the ecological niche, if the environment of that microorganism, the bug, has changed and it wasn't around before 2012, that could then fit with the theory as to why we're now seeing this disease. And that's where some of our research work is focused at the moment. So, you know, everything I'm saying is speculative, but we've got these theories and we're trying to answer some of the questions through the research work that's being done.
So there'd be a suspicion that something changed environmentally in those areas, perhaps, in 2012.
It's a possibility, yeah. So if there is indeed an environmental trigger and it is indeed a microorganism, so some form of bug, then yes, it's possible that that bug wasn't present prior to 2012 or has somehow evolved to now be triggering disease in dogs.
And originally, I guess you were seeing cases that were quite local to you or within a referral range, but we're seeing this all over the country. How do you explain that? I mean, I can get my non-veterinary head around the fact that something might have changed in a local environment or area, but obviously if it's a nationwide problem, the plot thickens, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, absolutely. And I suppose what's difficult, if we think back to 2012, 2013, you know, that's when we started identifying cases, and we know that some of these dogs were living in and around the New Forest area on the south coast. But I suppose the big question for me for that time period is, you know, this disease wouldn't have been high on vet radars. So actually, you know, was the disease around that sort of time, but it just wasn't being recognized. You know, we were sort of fortunate in that we saw two or three cases at a very close period of time. And I use the word fortunate in the sense of, you know, putting the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together. Whereas, you know, you can imagine a vet in practice, you know, sees one dog, a bit like us when we saw the first dog, you don't necessarily think a huge amount about it. So, yeah, so as I say, maybe in 2012, 2013, the cases were already there across the whole of the UK. It was just that we were recognising them because they'd been living and walking in the New Forest. So we definitely had a geographical cluster in the New Forest in February, March of 2013. We then had a second geographical cluster in Greater Manchester between February and April in 2014. And then really since that time, we've been seeing cases from across the whole of the UK much of the time. We know that 91% of cases we see between the November and May sort of time period. So that's really, you know, that's the worrying time period when we're more likely to see disease. But yes, you know, this disease is across the UK. Sometimes people have used the word spread, and I don't think that's the correct word to use. You know, I think this disease probably has been present across the whole of the UK since around that 2012, 2013 time period.
Mm-hmm. And as we said at the top of this, we've had 23 confirmed cases so far this year. Is the number of confirmed cases going up?
So it fluctuates. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it bounces around a little year on year. So I mean, as a comparator to last year, we had 47 in the whole of 2020. But remembering that we see the majority of the cases between November and May, so often case numbers look, very high in the first two quarters of the year, because we've got that time period, January to May. So, probably we're tracking at about the same case rate as we were in 2020 at this current period of time. And then in preceding years, it's fluctuated. So you might have one year when it's a little higher, and then another year when you're, down in the 20s.
Mm-hmm. And most or all dogs would present with the same symptoms, the cutaneous ulceration of distal limbs, ventrum, muzzle, and or tongue, and then leading on to acute kidney failure.
Yeah, absolutely. So the vast majority of dogs, not all, but the vast majority of dogs would initially present with these skin lesions. There's no pathognomonic appearance for them. So, there's not a picture of one lesion that I can show you and say, this is a CRGV skin lesion. But in 80% of patients, they're on the limbs, often below the elbow, below the knee, sometimes interdigitally. When I read the histories that vets have written, they're understandably confused with other things like interdigital foreign bodies or just areas of dermatitis. Some of them are very well demarcated ulcerative type lesions. Others are much more innocuous and just a patch of hairless red skin. I think the vets in practice will be seeing huge numbers of skin cases, and the chances of it actually being on CRGV are incredibly low. The real difficulty, however, is that, because the lesions can look so innocuous, it's one of those things that you can never really say it's not CRGV. And what we end up using is the time period to say, well, actually, let's say it's August, the chances of seeing a CRGV case in August are so incredibly low that it just drops right to the bottom of your differential list. Whereas if it's January, then probably it has to sit a little higher up that differential list.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so 80% have these skin lesions at initial presentation. There are a small subset of patients that have systemic clinical signs, so the signs referable to acute kidney injury before they develop skin lesions, but that is the minority. And probably worth just pointing out that the average time period between the development of a skin lesion and progression to acute kidney injury is around 3 days. So that's the average, but the range is up to over a month. So that's probably, it's a key piece of information. And then, I suppose the other thing I would want people to be mindful of is, based upon the literature, the papers from the US in the 80s and 90s, then there is definitely a subset of dogs out there who only develop skin lesions without going on and developing kidney failure. And we think we're seeing that population in the UK as well.
Okay, so a very difficult thing to diagnose. Thankfully, a rare condition, but sadly, in 90% of cases, a fatal one.
Yeah, unfortunately so. Yeah, mortality is high once they develop acute kidney injury. But just going back to what I said, there's definitely a subset that just develop skin lesions, and that population of dogs should have a very high survival rate. Almost 100%.
So some dogs will just develop the lesions and some will then go on to develop acute kidney failure. But you talked earlier about a predisposition. Would that be a predisposition to both of those things? So something that will cause these ulcerations, but not necessarily in some dogs, lead on to the acute kidney failure. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very insightful question. And the answer is, we don't know. Thinking about it right down to the cellular level, what is it that causes some dogs to just develop skin lesions and other dogs to go on and develop acute kidney injury? There was an interesting question posed in the US, which is, actually the dogs that just have skin lesions without developing blood test changes of kidney failure, then actually maybe they do have kidney changes, but it's just at a level that's not bad enough for them to develop the blood test changes. So if you did a biopsy of those dogs' kidneys, I'm not advocating that and we wouldn't do it, but if you did do a biopsy of those dogs' kidneys, there's every possibility that you would see some change. It's just that change would be so mild, they haven't got the blood test changes, so you don't call it acute kidney injury.
It really is quite a puzzle, that's for sure. But there have been some successes with treating this. We spoke a few weeks ago about the case of Molly. Just tell us about that particular case and what you guys did down there to pull her through.
So you're right, James. I mean, there have been some patients that survive. It's around 10%. I think what's really frustrating for us is that we don't do anything different or differently between patients. You know, we approach them all in the same way. Because we don't know what the cause is at the moment, then there's no specific therapy. What we're doing to manage these patients is very intensively managing their acute kidney injury that they develop. So with Molly that survived, there wasn't anything particularly different than we did with the, you know, other tens of dogs that we've seen. A lot of it just comes down to, you know, good fortune, incredibly committed owners who are willing to ride out the, you know, the real nadir when the dogs are feeling incredibly unwell, their urine output is very poor, their creatinine's very high, you know, very committed owners who were prepared to push through that. And yeah, Molly was very fortunate and came out the other side. But yeah, as I said, I would love to come on here and say, you know, we did this. This is this amazing piece of information that I can pass on to vets in practice that's going to increase the likelihood of survival. But, you know, a lot of it was down to good fortune. And perhaps Molly had, you know, more reversible injury within her kidneys than some of the other dogs that we're seeing. The degree of injury that some of these dogs have within their kidneys is just profound. I showed some of the tissue to a human kidney specialist pathologist who deals with children who have similar diseases. And, you know, he was just astonished at the severity of the change within these dogs' kidneys and really wasn't surprised that they weren't managing to pull through.
No. And there have been some other treatments used. I think back in 2018, the RVC had six dogs there. They used therapeutic plasma exchange to filter the blood. What are your thoughts on that? Because I think of the six dogs, two actually made a full recovery.
Yes, I mean, I suppose just to give a bit of background on that. So therapeutic plasma exchange is a technique where basically you're taking out plasma from an affected dog and then giving them new plasma. The reason that we think that might be useful is based upon the fact that there are similar diseases in people to CRGV where there's an overdrive of the body's complement system. So that's part of the body that helps the immune system clear organisms from the body. So that's sort of the theory behind it. So in its most simplistic form, it's taking away the dog's bad plasma and giving it healthy plasma, which is basically renewing this complement system that's gone into overdrive. And it's that complement system that's thought to damage the kidney and the skin. So the theory behind it is absolutely fantastic. When you look at analogous conditions in human medicine, then with some of them, it seems to work, and with some of them, less so. I think at the moment in dogs, the jury's still out. You know, the way we're trying to tackle it is to investigate the disease a little bit more. So start to look at this complement system in dogs affected by CRGV and compare that to normal dogs. If we could prove that there's a problem with the complement system, then it would increase our desire to go down the route of therapeutic plasma exchange. You mentioned the six dogs that were reported out of a fantastic paper that they published in 2018, and only two of them survived. But, you know, it's relatively low case numbers. It's very difficult to draw out a conclusion from that. The challenge is, you know, it's a very expensive technique, so it's not available to a lot of pet owners. So financially, some people don't want to go through it. Understandably, emotionally, some people don't want to put their pets through it because it's quite an involved process. So yeah, I think in 2 or 3 years' time, we'll probably have some bigger case numbers coming out of the RVC, and then there might be a slightly clearer picture as to whether or not that's truly helping.
Mm-hmm. And just to touch on that sort of collaborative working on this disease, I know this started off pretty much you guys down at Anderson Moore, but just tell us a little bit now. It's a network now and a real joined up effort to try and crack this puzzle.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, our intention was always to just try and push some information out through the veterinary literature and, you know, and then through great media outlets like yourselves to try and increase awareness across the UK. And what we've now done is, yeah, we have ties with a number of academic institutions. So we're working with the University of Bristol and we've now got a nice biobank down there, so all the samples are able to be stored in minus 80 freezers, which is great for future research. We've got ties with the University of Surrey, and I'm actually co-supervising a PhD student there, and he's doing some great work trying to investigate this disease process, and then ties in with the RVC as well, especially their epidemiology department, looking at various aspects of the disease. So, you know, that really has been fantastic, and we've got some great minds now working on this disease, and research is really moving forward apace. It was really tough at the beginning to try and get people interested. You know, everyone's busy, so much going on, so much fantastic research going on. But yeah, I really feel like over the past couple of years, things have started to move forward. And as we start to get more answers, then that'll pose more questions, which will make it easier to apply for grants and get more research money coming in. So, you know, I'm really hoping that over the next 5 years, we can make great strides forwards in understanding more about this disease process.
And just a final point, I'm not going to put you on the spot for time frames, but are you confident that we can find the answer and get this thing sorted out and solved?
Confident would be the wrong word. I think referring back to my previous answer, I think, you know, we're moving forward far faster than we were. You know, it's like a big jigsaw puzzle. And, you know, initially we were putting pieces in very slowly. The pieces are going in far faster now. So I think more answers will come. There are plenty of disease examples out there where, you know, people have spent their whole careers researching the disease and we still don't have all of the answers. So, you know, all of the answers might not come, but I'm confident in saying that we're going to get more answers over the coming years.
And obviously, just as a final point, this all relies to a certain extent on vets being vigilant for it, keeping their eye out for it, and reporting things back to you guys so that can all be fed in to this project.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, we really want to keep an eye on case numbers to see what's changing. That allows us then to gather some epidemiological data from the patients. And, you know, from an individual dog and vet practice point of view, you know, it's useful for us to be able to confirm the diagnosis. You know, hopefully that gives the owner some degree of closure in that devastating circumstance. What it also allows us to do then is have some samples that we can do work with moving forward, because ultimately, you know, that's the only way that we're going to unravel this mystery, is by having those samples that we can really interrogate. So yes, you're completely right. If people are willing, then we're very, very happy to provide advice on cases would love to be involved and be contacted if vets are seeing suspected cases.
Great stuff. Well, that seems like a good place to leave it. Thanks ever so much for joining me, David, and hopefully maybe we'll hook up again and do another little update in a month or two's time.
Yeah, sounds great. Many thanks, James.